To every single person that is about to come across this screen, this was wonderful. I enjoyed every second of this playthrough. And the amount of effort and work and just detail. I mean, it's just, you could tell that a lot of love went into this game. I would love to talk with game devs about psychological components in their games.
Oh, Tim, I was, when Spaff reached out to me and asked if I wanted to talk to you, I was like, absolutely, I would love to talk to you. And they, I don't know how much they've talked to you about talking to me, but I know you're probably used to like interview format and sort of like a podcasting type format. And I certainly have like questions I would love to ask you and things that just stood out to me from playing the game, but I also sort of view it, I don't know, sort of as like a conversation. Like I really, having the opportunity to talk to you and hear your thoughts about a game that I honestly like was not fully on my radar. I've known about Psychonauts for a long time, but I never had an original Xbox when I was a kid when the original one came out, so I never got to play it. And then Jared, who's actually in this call, suggested that I play Psychonauts 2 because I stream and play games and use those games to illustrate psychological concepts, and obviously Psychonauts is about the best possible example I could ever think of, given that psychology is such a part of the game. It's literally the core foundation. So I have so many questions and so many things that I would love to talk to you about, and if there are things that you want to ask me or whatever, bring to my attention as well, I'm more than open to hearing whatever you have to say or whatever questions you might have too. I don't know how much of my playthrough you saw, but I'm really honored that you would have watched any of it and that the studio is promoting it in the way that they are. That's really cool. I guess just out of curiosity, how did my playthrough come to your attention?
It might have been Paul Levering. It was posted on our internal Slack. Like, hey, check this out. This is the team really enjoyed it because of the insight you brought to it. But just naturally, because you were going so deep into the concepts, it led people to feel really, I think, appreciated, because there is a lot of thought put into the game of like, let's think this through. Like, what does this mean? Why is this actor saying this thing in this way? What does it mean if we cut the camera in this way? Like, it can all have such an impact. And it felt like someone was really like noticing all these things that, and then taking it further, taking it to their interpretation. Like, what does this mean to me because of my background, you know? And so just whenever you work so hard on a game, like the team worked on this game, it's great to see someone get a lot out of it, even if it's like a different perspective, or it's they're bringing to it their own perspective, which is content people didn't expect to be appreciated, you know?
Yeah, did that ever like cross your mind as you, I know that this is many, many, many years in the making, like had that ever crossed your mind, like the idea of having a psychologist or therapist play your game and interpret it? And I guess what's that like to think about that happening? Because I would imagine like if I put something out there and there were like professionals in that field that were playing it and analyzing it, that would be a pretty wild experience. Like, had you ever considered that that would be something that would happen?
Later on, and it was terrifying. It's really terrifying because you're like, because I am not a professional in any way when it comes to psychology or therapy or anything like that, you know, and I'm just a layman who has emotions and lives a life, you know, and thinks about these things. And I'm definitely interested. But it's really scary because we didn't really mess anything up. And that's where later in the process, we, you know, definitely not in the first game at all. You know, we were like, I was really young and we're just like much 20 years ago. And we were just having fun and interested in these topics and probably had a natural sense of empathy and not wanting to, you know, be mean spirited about stuff, which I think kept us in a safer zone. But, during the second game, we're like, you know, it's been a long time. Society has changed. We've changed. And we're just a lot more intentional about what we got right and, you know, intentional about what we wanted to change about the first game when we approached the second one. And we started thinking about how can we get, you know, trained professionals to look at this. And when we got acquired by Microsoft, they had a whole group that could help us with that, too. And they hooked us up with TakeThis.org, you know, is a group that helped us review the game and actually changed a lot of the language in the game and helped us write that mental health advisory at the beginning and helped us essentially just, you know, we don't want to make anything that causes harm. You know, that's not the point of this entertainment product that we're making, you know, and through our own just blind spots or whatever. So it's intimidating, but it's nice to hear that we didn't, you know, that we got some things, more things right than we got the first time around. So it's always getting better.
That's is there, when you guys were doing that consulting, that was actually something that I was really curious about. When I was playing the game, I was thinking to myself, there were so many things that were, as far as I was concerned, like you guys nailed it. And when you were doing some of that consulting with them and bringing those third parties in to open some of those ideas up and analyze them from that point of view, were there any like changes or alterations or thoughts that they gave you guys as part of input that were particularly impactful for how you were putting these ideas together?
I think it was. Well, I was really relieved because we had some things I thought were going to get us in trouble, like the panic attack, because it was so, if, you know, if you're prone to getting a panic attack, that might be really a frightening thing to look at and to be, you know, the way we treated it was almost to try and generate that feeling in the player of like panic, which is dangerous, you know, to do. Sure, but sure. One of our first people checking it out, Dr. B at Take This, was like, I get panic attacks, and that was really meaningful to me, and I really appreciated that. And it was more that it felt like someone was saying that they knew what it was like to get a panic attack. It felt like it was, you know, it was like being seen in a way. And so it shows us something I think is important, which is that we tend to, you know, people are a lot more sensitive in these days about like doing things wrong and entertainment or something, getting in trouble publicly and being, you know, and shamed for it. And it doesn't, so they tend to like back off of everything. Well, let's not get into any topics, you know? And so, it was really, nice that it felt like it proved that you can get into stuff with people. If you have the right frame of mind, if you have the right, approach, which is based on like evidence and not stereotypes, that you can get into real stuff, and some of it really negative, really harsh and frightening to people. As long as there's warnings and there's a sensitive treatment to it, you can, and we should. Art, you know, I feel like games are art, and they should get into topics about real life. Yeah,
and I agree with that completely. And something that I bump into a lot as a therapist is I see so many people that have these inaccurate representations of what it is that they're struggling with. I mean, panic attacks notwithstanding. And to see you, like, what I think is so powerful about what you created is to have those like very concrete visual representations of these things that you also get to interact with in some way and actually fight against. And so like to take panic attacks, that you brought that up, like that was, I think, one of the more powerful enemies, so to speak, in terms of what it represented. How did you come up with the idea of how to represent it as this like big rainbow, jagged edges, unpredictable? Like where did that idea come from? What is that process like to like make something concrete out of a really abstract concept?
Mm-hmm. I think it's real. Everyone on the team adds some aspect of that, and having a team that gets together and talks about the psychological aspect of it, but like the gameplay aspect of it, the visual effects aspect of it, like so many people brought different parts of it. You know, we have an artist who just doodles, like, let's take all these words that represent mental constructs and just you're using in your own impressionistic way, draw a panic attack. You know, draw this, just like, you know, what does it mean to you? So Scott Campbell would draw a bunch of drawings about that. And then on the other side of it, our designers were like, you know, what kind of, sometimes it's just the nuts and bolts of like, what kind of enemy do we want to have here? And, oh, we wanted to have this fast enemy. And like, well, what would that kind of feel like? It feels like a little bit like panic, you know? And so sometimes these ideas just kind of link across creative individuals. And then, you know, our effects artist is like, oh, I've got this, I happen to have this great idea for how something can move, you know? And sometimes it's just all these different people bringing their own piece of the puzzle together that, that create a final thing, like the panic attack. And I get to lay dialogue on top of it, and it makes it look like we planned the whole thing exactly. But sometimes it is this just layered thing where everyone's like, I've got something I can add to that.
It all just comes together beautifully. So my understanding is that you were the sole writer of the game. Is that correct? That like the script itself was written by you?
I wrote all the dialogue, but you know, it always is a process that involves the whole, you know, team and whole design team as far as figuring out what that writing is going to be.
Okay. When, so like with, again, to use panic attacks, but also like, I mean, I'm thinking about like the doubts and regrets, like holding their weight and stuff. I would imagine that there was some thought that went into, well, there was obviously had to have been thought based on my experience of playing the game and how you fight those items. Like, so like a panic attack, it's not something necessarily that you want to like escalate or add a bunch of complexity to when you're having one in real life. And one of the things that I thought was so cool was the way the primary mechanism that you fight the panic attack with is to slow it down and to like use that power that Raz has to try to slow it down so you can attack it in a very intentional way. Is that something that you were thinking about from the beginning with some of these enemy types? Or is that something that like you created the enemy type and then it was, well, let's figure out what it would actually realistically take to fight this thing. Cause I could not believe how well that was done. And it felt like it had to be intentional.
Sometimes it came from different angles. Like every enemy would be approached in a different way. Like the sensors, which are the really oldest enemy from the first game, you know, they came straight out of reading On Dreams by Freud. You know, she just talks about how awesome. You know, we wake up, dreams have this nonsensical quality, and we wake up and these sensors are released in our brains that just stamp out all the ideas that are nonsensical, right? And that's, you know, he had this idea about mental health problems being like sometimes the sensors aren't there. They're not running around mm-hmm. stamping out things that aren't, you know, don't make sense. You know, so that was like just a straight lift out of the textbook that I read in college when I was in my psychology class. And then some of the enemies come from a design point of view, like just the combat team. Like we need a ranged enemy, or we need, you know, this kind of enemy. And then it might be a creative thing that then starts to suggest a certain, like, what does that enemy feel like? Oh, that feels like a doubt or regret, or it just feels like, you know, something like we had the support mechanism. There's a unit that kind of is a supporter, and it eventually got the idea to call it an enabler, and that seemed to, now all of a sudden it clicks, like the theme kind of clicks in. It's like these are bad feelings and this enabler is like supporting this really negative thought process in the person's head. So having it be like a cheerleader or a majorette, you know, just made sense. So
it was so perfect.
It was awesome. Yeah. So it's really a combination of the art team, the combat team, design team. And then sometimes, you know, I was kidding about laying writing on top of it, but sometimes you get, it all starts to fit together and you're like, hey, you know what this is? This is an enabler. And you put that word on it and it makes it look like the whole thing was intentional from the beginning, but it's almost more like recognizing what you've made, like making something first and then recognizing, hey, what that is, that's an enabler.
It's the enabler was my favorite part of the entire game. Every single time I saw one, I would laugh so hard, like, because they just, oh my god, like the whole art design on that, making it this the cheerleader baton person from like a marching, I mean, everything about that was so perfect. And it's really cool to hear you talk about that process, because it's that process in some ways I think runs parallel to just when people maybe access therapy, where they come in with all these like ideas and experience of what's going on, and they'll describe things, and then I will label that for them, or like help them find that, or like draw upon certain theories to be like, well, it sounds like what you might be dealing with is, I mean, I suppose like enabler, or it sounds like you're dealing with significant regret or panic. And the amount of release that brings at times for people when they have something like that named and represented for them is so powerful. And so to see that in video game form, where people can connect with these different characters, where maybe they even take that to their therapist and say, oh my god, I was playing this game called Psychonauts and there was this enabler, and it was like this thing that exacerbated all these thoughts and protected them, and I feel like that's what's going on for me. Do you ever think about like the impact that type of representation in your game could have on like what people bring to their therapy on their own or to their own understanding of their psychology?
I mean, it's not, I think it comes naturally from the fact that therapy was one of the, a form of therapy was a really specific inspiration for the Psychonauts. Like all of Psychonauts comes from a certain study of therapy. In college, I took a class on the psychology of dreams where I read that Freud book. We read a lot of Carl Jung on dreams, which is shown in Cassie's level, I think, especially in everywhere. And then we studied a lot of quantitative analysis, but also just Gestalt therapy. and we saw videos of old Esalen therapy circles. You know Esalen?
Yes.
The kind of resort from the end of Mad Men on the coast of Big Sur in California, where there are these group therapy circles, and people were talking about their dreams and sharing their dreams. And there was a woman who was saying, my dreams are boring. It's just like this lake, and there's a fountain in the middle of the lake, and that's all there is. And then they did this role playing based on the dreams, where the woman would, the thought being, everything in your dream is just you, is some aspect of you. And the woman started role playing. She's like, "You want me to role play a lake?" He's like, "Yeah, I'm a lake. I'm crystal clear. My water is so, it's clean. It's really delicious and beautiful. And there's a fountain, and the water keeps coming out of it and keeps pouring and giving, offering up all this water. And it's so clean, but no one's drinking it. And it just keeps giving and giving and giving." She like bursts into tears, and she started describing this like fountain that's always giving this water that nobody wants. And it was so amazing. There are all these examples of that where, like, you know, even if you dream of something scary, like a bear, like that's some part of you, that's some part of your thoughts, you know. And if you role play it, if you like put a voice to that bear, like you can sometimes discover these things that are representing. Because it's not like everything is a literal, like when we're kids and we read dream theory books, there's always like a 1001 dreams and what they mean. Like, oh, you dreamt about teeth, that means you're worried about your aging or something. It's like astrology a little bit, like it seems right. Oh, that sounds right. But it's usually not that cut and dry, obviously, but they do seem to be tied to stress and emotion and things going on in your mind. And maybe it's, I don't know how scientific you can be about dreams or not. But sometimes it's like, it's just like tarot cards, you know, if you've ever, like tarot cards. I'm not saying that the cards have mystical powers that predict your future, but when you're interpreting your own like tarot, like, oh, I laid this out, death, what does that mean to you? And the person is kind of psychoanalyzing themselves. They're kind of saying, oh, well, that's probably what my fear about my mom has cancer or something like that. And so it is meaningful because the person is like just being guided into self-analyzing themselves, because they really know the most about, in some ways, what's going on, but they just don't know how to do it. And so the dream therapy was one way of doing that. And I thought it was so beautiful how people, when you dream, you're creating these really poetic metaphors every night when you sleep. You know, these things we expect from poet laureates and like from novelists, you know, creating the bear as a symbol for this, you know, but people are doing it every night as they say, and are all capable of these amazing metaphors. And wouldn't that be a fun game? So that led to the idea that became Psychonauts. So it really is a game that came out of therapy.
That's awesome. Like, was there a moment within like studying all these things and being exposed to them where you can remember that like thought of this should be a game? Like, was it the fountain thing, or was there a certain experience you had where it's like, this has got to turn into something that other people can really access and enjoy in a meaningful way?
It really slowly over years, like it was, I feel like it must have been like out of college at least 10 years and just thinking about this concept in my head, making games, you know. It was after Grim Fandango and I was making, you know, a game about a person who had visions, and they had visions, and they would analyze their visions to find out clues, and so they kind of were going into their own head. And someone said, "Hey, I heard you're working on this game about going into other people's heads." And I was like, no, you go into your own head. Wait a second. Wait, that's better. That's definitely better, going into other people's heads. Oh my gosh. So in some ways it was like, you know, creativity is weird. Sometimes something sits dormant in your brain for many years, and then someone says something and you mishear it, and then you're like, wait a second. And it just light goes off, so to speak.
How much, if in thinking about, like, you know, when people are in their head, they create, they have these creations that come up, like you're describing, that would suggest to me that there is maybe in some kind of meta way that when folks are playing Psychonauts 2, they are in some way also in Tim Schafer's head. And I'm wondering, like, what aspects of the game do you see as being like representations of like your own mind, or things that are sort of related to that creative process for you that maybe carry the most meaning?
Wow, it's really, sometimes I don't even know what they are, you know, because you follow these kind of instinctual things when you're writing. And it's not just me, but every team that I work with brings a different vibe. I could only make this game with this team, you know, so it's hard to pinpoint exact things. Because, you know, I, like one weird example is I was telling someone about, you know, as a kid, I was collecting polywogs in this river, and then the school bully came over and like kicked over my bucket of polywogs. I was like six or something like that, and it was sad. And I said that his name was Bobby, and someone said Bobby, like Bobby in Second Hots One, the bully in Second Hots One. I was like, oh my god! Like I didn't even realize I had, you know. So like, because you're being creative, you're pulling stuff out of your unconscious mind, and you're just, you don't know. People, artists are always like, well, this is what I meant with this work. This is what this work means. Like, no, that's what that work means to you on the surface. But like, you pulled something out of your unconscious mind and you don't really know what you made. And someone else might look at it and see something deeper or see their own interpretation, which is just as valid. So it's really hard for me to pinpoint one thing or two things that are in the game that are like, yeah, that's me. Because who knows? It's like leaving your dream journal out for everyone to read. It's embarrassing.
Sure. Have you, in talking to folks who have played the game or seeing any bits of people who have played the game, are there any interpretations or experiences that people have had from the game that they shared with you that you were really surprised about or you hadn't anticipated that people would have?
Oh, gosh. I mean, we've gotten so many letters over the years. Like, in some ways, it's like a lot of it is their personal memories of how they experienced the game. Almost more than the content of the game, like it's they played it with their dad, or they played it with their mom, or they had these memories of playing the game. There's sometimes negative things, like someone, you know, the first game had asylum horror in it, which is really not a thing that is looked on favorably these days. And back then we didn't know, but someone did write a letter about that and how that made them feel, and so that was like, we learned a lot from our fans in general, and that was one of the examples. But everyone, the fact that someone would be positively affected by that betrayal of a panic attack, for example, I was like, that's great. So, I mean, we wouldn't have, yeah. Anyway, so you never know. That's why it's so important to test and check your stuff, because you know, they're words that you use, and there's ways you portray things that you don't realize people are going to interpret in their own. Everyone interprets things differently, and you want to, you know, people always complain about this date. They always bring up like, oh, cancel culture. You can't have anything provocative in your game. That's not the case. You're always, when you're doing something creative, thinking about what impact that has on the person who's taking it in. You know, if you're making a horror movie, like, I want to scare people. I'm thinking about, are you scared? And if you're not scared, I'm doing it wrong. So you're always thinking about, you know, comedy, you're making people laugh. So you're always, so, and it's probably, especially making a game like Psychonauts, which is a comedy, it's not in your head to like, I want to injure people and scar them for life. That's not one of your goals. So like, you want to check it and make sure you're not harming people or making them relive traumas, or, you know, we didn't think about it as much in the first game. We were just like trying to make entertainment. We're like, we were really interested in these psychological concepts, but we were just trying to make something fun and funny. And then it was actually our voice producer, Chris Brown, who was in the studio, and we were recording Benita Soleil's, you know, she has this actress who has this level where she's reliving the memories of her mom committing suicide. And then at the end of it, she comes out of her shell, and she's this bright glowing beam of sunshine. And she goes, you know what I like about this game is that every level is about healing. And I was like, I didn't even realize that. And that would... Hearing her say that made me think about, like, that's all of a sudden having this responsibility of like, oh yeah, we got to make sure we're doing that right. If every, you know, every level could be about healing. And we were kind of doing it on accident, but it was a really nice thing to keep in mind when we're doing the second game of like, how do you leave every mind better off than you went into it? You know, even the bad guy, you know, like how do you, you know, in a shooter, if you go through a factory, you're blowing out pillars. You're setting fire to the place, and the building just falls apart when you leave it. You know what I mean? And so Psychonauts game has to be the opposite, where you're cleaning out the emotional baggage and you're like actually kind of giving a tune up and doing all this nice, mental therapy to it and then leaving it off better off than when you entered it.
I appreciate so much the like attention to that, and that's something that's so important to you, and that when it was brought to your attention, it was like this, okay, we need to make sure that we continue to do that. And I think even on top of that, because sometimes I think when we think about psychology, there's this idea that it's easy to resolve these things, that it's something that like we can all heal if we just set our mind to it. And one of the things that I think is cool about the path that you all took in the game is that despite the fact that you would come out of each mind with this sense of healing, there was also a lot of work to be done in order to push through that and to like to go into some of the like difficult representations and the dark thoughts and the connections as a way of like, sure, we can get there, but it also is going to require a bit of work. And sometimes it requires a bit of outside help, which as a therapist, I appreciate, even if passively, that represents what I do positively of like having this outside influence. As I was going through, like, I'm thinking about like Bob's journey when you're going to the different islands and you're helping him like deal with some of the alcoholism that touched his family and touched him and his mother, or going through Forsyth's, like the gambling aspect, going through the casinos and all these things. Like, I'm curious about the process that you would go through as a creative team of how do we determine what this person's main struggle is in this moment, what that healing looks like, and how we get them from point A to point B. Like, how do you guys do that? And how did you come up with those things?
Well, so for some levels, a lot of it would come from, there may be an overarching concept of like, in this game, we actually dealt out these cards. These like five elements I always think about as being part of a Psychonauts level, which is the host, their mental condition, their the aesthetic, the setting, and like a twist. So like in, say, Boyd's Milkman Conspiracy in the first game, you have Boyd, the host. He's excessively paranoid, The setting is a suburbs, and the aesthetic is like 1950s, like mid-century type thing. And the twist is that there's relative gravity and the roads are all twisted around. So we wrote all these and made examples of each one on these cards, and then we shuffled them up and we dealt them all out, you know, and there was concepts of going into the mind of someone who is like either under the effects of some sort of drug or alcohol, or how do you represent addiction? And we're talking about it with team. We're like, well, that's kind of a heavy thing to get into, is addiction with people. Like, how do you go into someone's mind and like fix, are you going to make them not an alcoholic, or like, you're going to, you know, and we went different ways with both the levels. Cause the Hollis's level, where she gets into gambling because of some interference by Raz, was based on reading about some theories about addiction being about bad connections, about connections between what releases thrills or something being this risk, and that that there's a short circuit in some ways. Some people have like what triggers excitement and happiness being is somewhat negative, these triggers. And then with Bob's Bottles, it was some input from the team. One of the team members sat through a whole meeting and then afterwards came up to me and was like, you know, in my family, when someone had an alcohol problem, it was what we learned. It was not about the chemicals and the booze. It's about their breaking off their connections with their family. You know, they had actually severed all their connections with everyone in their life, which helped them fall into this pit of just spiral of just negative, you know, just self-harm, because no one was watching them, because they weren't sharing their feelings with anybody. It was easier to do that to themselves. And so that's why Bob's naturally suggested a level where Bob was on an island all by himself, you know, separated from all these painful memories of people he loved and lost, or bad things that had happened in his life. And so it suggested kind of a metaphor, and if you can imagine the mental condition in just one image. Like, you imagine someone who's separated from their whole family, and just see this guy on a desert island all by himself, and you can kind of see his what's wrong, you know, in that one picture. And that's always a great way to start the level. Like, here's what's wrong in one picture. How do you help? You know, what is Bob doing? So like but level designers and the concept artists and everybody bring something to like bring that picture to life. And that's how we approached it with those two levels.
I love that. The idea of it being like one picture is, I think it's a really a powerful thing to set the tone, and also for people to be able to connect with. So that it brings me maybe to like a more broad question as we're talking about all these things, which is, when you think about Psychonauts 1 or Psychonauts 2 or both of them combined, and the impact that it may have on like the psychology of the folks who play it, or just as a window into different theories and ideas as it relates to psychology, is there a major like takeaway that you hope that folks take from the game, and they after you finish playing Psychonauts, where like you would say, I'm so glad that a person would walk away with this in their mind after they finish my, after they finish this game that we've created. Is that something that you consider? And if so, what is that?
I think it's something that's important to me is just that idea that no matter how someone is acting, they're exhibiting some horrible negative behavior in the real world. You don't know what's going on inside their mind. And the idea, even with the quote unquote villains in all these games, is that you go into their minds and you see what they're wrestling with and you can see how it's making them behave badly. But it's that it's not, it's just video games. It's just really easy to write off enemies. So you feel okay shooting them. Usually it's like, and that's where, mm-hmm. you know, the most, I think the most dangerous thing about mental health in video games is that it's you make, or villains in movies or anything, just, you got to give them enough of a quirk to people go, oh, they're crazy. They use that word, right. Like, okay, I don't need to worry about, you know, morally anymore because that person is a different, like, they're a different thing than me. I'm a sane person, they're an insane person. There's a big wall between us, you know, as opposed to like all the, you know, the spectrum in between you, the hero and the villain, and all the different choices they make. And just they genetically are pretty much identical and they have the very similar brains. It was just a, you know, a few different changes that led to these different behaviors. But, you know, we go to Coach Oleander's mind, you see his trauma from his father, that, you know, his bad relationships there and what that led him to do. And just the idea that, I think everyone in everyone in the Psychonauts game is redeemed or seen as redeemable because you see inside their brain and everybody is redeemable, you know, inside. It helps tear down that wall that you kind of imagine is between you and other people. You know, they realize that everyone is struggling with something.
I often say that, I mean, I've learned this over 10 years almost now of being a therapist, that really if you ask people the right questions and you stay curious about their experience and where they're coming from, you'll find usually that the decisions people make sense to them. That there's rarely do people do things that are not like sensical to them, or at the very least, like, usually well-intentioned, even if the behaviors themselves are not so great. And so to hear that again is part of like what you all are considering when you're crafting this, I think is something that really separates the game, because even Maligula, by the end of the game, when she's holding onto the pit, she says, "You'll never get rid of me." Even that, there's this piece of like some understanding of where Maligula came from and why she was there based on like the vaults that you access and all that. And in that line, I guess I was curious, just as being part of the, you know, folks that created the game, what was Maligula in your mind a representation of? Like, what was she? Because Raz says there's a piece of you in all of us, and I'm curious from you, yeah, like what it was, what does that mean, and what was that about?
I watched that part of your stream, of course, and I saw that it is something I'm not sure we got successfully across to everybody, at least what our interpretation of Maligula was, because it was, we did get some feedback in our first playtest of like, how am I supposed to forgive someone who's basically Hitler? And I was like, well, that's not what I was trying to say. First of all, there's Maligula, you know, I'm not trying to excuse drowning a few people, but no, it wasn't supposed to be that she had this genocidal side to her or anything like that. The idea was that, and it's something that wouldn't be part of like everyday psychology, I think, because the idea is that, this is embarrassing, we used to call what Maligula had a mental Balrog, because the idea was that the Psychonauts dug too deep in the mines of Moria, but they dug too deep inside of, to make all these Lord of the Rings references that hopefully everyone gets, but just that when they were doing all this, Ford talks about it a little bit, in the early days of Psychonauts, they were opening all these doors in the mind, implying whether it was psychedelics or whatever they were doing, they were like the NASA of the mind. They were just exploring the human mind, opening all these potentials, and just digging way down into their unconscious minds to like make discoveries. And they went so deep that they were kind of vulnerable. And then she was shipped off to war. She saw all these traumas in war that pushed to like harder and harder by the Tsar of Grulovia to like drown the enemy. And, you know, she came to, you know, help with like irrigation, and she ended up drowning enemy soldiers and then drowning in her own people as crowd control. As basically the door was open and this like thing from the deeper part of her brain came out. And the idea was that it was like a manifestation of a really primal, like a violent survival instinct that I do think everybody has. Like, I do think everyone has a very, like, animalistic, when they're under threat, when they're being chased by a mountain lion, or like when they're in a fist fight or something, like, this real, like, people, everyone thinks they're not violent, but in those kind of, like, fight or flight situations, I think there is this, like, violent thing that we all have and that we all control. We all part of society. We don't go around killing people, but we have it, you know, we just keep it way, it's way, way down. It doesn't come up unless you're physically threatened, usually, you know, and the idea was that the Psychonauts opened up too many doors and then put her in a situation that was really traumatizing, which caused these deep, you know, deep primal things to become too big and too powerful in her mind. And she was able to kind of like seal it back up in her lizard brain or whatever and get rid of it. So this is, I think, part where Psychonauts goes beyond everyday therapy, because it's not often that it's almost like a fantasy mental concept that mm-hmm. you could get down, almost more like if you've ever seen Altered States with William Hurt, that old 70s movie where he uses psycho-isolation chambers to get into his like caveman brain, and he like mm-hmm. transforms himself into a Neanderthal or something. So that's the idea. It's getting into primitive parts of the human brain, which is a kind of it's just where it gets into the more fantasy aspect of the human mind. But I think it's interesting. So it's not meant to be that she was like, oh yeah, she had this genocidal side, but you know, she's got to forgive her. It's more just like this unnatural part of like her deep thing got overpowerful and took over her brain and made her into this violent person.
Which is a, I think, profoundly empathic way to approach her, which I think falls in line with what you're saying of like of everybody here is somebody who is redeemable in some way. So then that leads me to wonder what you would consider, and if you take the fantastical Psychonauts world that's been created, what would you say is the actual evil aspect of that world then? Like what is the anti-hero aspect of that world that people are fighting against and struggling against?
I mean, like, who is antagonist in Psychonauts? I mean, like, deep down, or?
Yeah, so, like, maybe not even, like, a person, per se. Like, is there a certain process? Like, would you say that the process of the Psychonauts digging too deep, or that these primal survival urges that folks have are potentially a problem? Like, what would you say is the thing that people are fighting against, or some dynamic that is problematic in that world that
is... I mean, the story, the specific story in Psychonauts 2 is a little bit about Graz growing up, where he's not at summer camp anymore, and he's gotten more powerful. And as he gets more powerful, his potential for doing harm is increased. And he goes into Hollis's mind and he messed with her wiring. Like, he crossed a line and thought he was helping and thought he was just a kid and he couldn't really hurt anybody. And that's why he gets called on the carpet for it, so strictly by Sasha, who's always been very kind to him. But he's like, you have a responsibility when you're in someone's mind to, like, you know, tread very lightly. And this, I think the game tried to recognize that in a few different ways. Like, it's one thing that occurred to me, like, wow, it's a really invasive process going into someone's mind. And the first game, you do it kind of willy-nilly, you just pop a door on someone's head and you're in there all the time. They're like, oh, that's really... So in the second game, you always get consent before you go into someone's mind. It's like a little dialogue choice before every brain, except for, like, I think Truman's, when it's an emergency. But everybody else, he asks. And so it's just like a small change, but it's like trying to recognize the responsibility of what goes on. So as far as what the evil they're trying to fight, it's more like getting into trying to figure out, there really are, one of the themes of the Psychonauts getting away from their initial reason for being. They've become a peacekeeping force, like an anti-terrorism force, but they started as a NASA for the mind, an exploratory force. So they're trying to learn the mysteries of the mind to help people, to help our concept of our both unlock human potential, but also, you know, help people deal with pain and things like that. So I think they really are just trying to understand what exists in the mind, but then to learn how the responsibility comes with that, to not do harm while you're in there.
So that allure of the power that people can sense at times when they are able to access the vulnerability of others, that's something that needs to be wielded responsibly, and if you don't, it causes problems. And I, the way that you, the way the whole foresight thing goes down, I think an absolutely beautiful example of that. And I also thought it was kind of neat that it the game feels like it's always attending to Raz's development, and so it's where even when she's angry at him for doing that, she still acknowledges, I understand why you did that, and here's why we shouldn't do that going forward. Is almost like a way to teach him that responsibility. And I have a background in development, so seeing that was attended to throughout the game to me, as well as another kind of meta conversation about him coming of age and learning what type of power he has, I think was also just a really powerful aspect of that.
That's awesome. I've always been interested in that, just because in growing up, I remember like as you get older, you sometimes learn by hurting people, and this is what sadly to say, but like in relationships, mm-hmm. you treat someone bad, and you're like, oh, that felt bad I really hurt that person's feelings. I didn't really mean to, but I thought I was just doing, you know, and you end up causing, hopefully not really, really hurting someone, but you definitely, by, you know, feeling out that, like, how to be a person, a lot of it is like, you'll end up hurting people along the way. And so recognizing that, and what you can learn from that, is like what Raz had to do. And I think it's what all of us have to do, because no one really gives you all the answers when you're growing up.
Of course not. And speaking of growing up, I wanted to ask you a little bit about Raz's family, because there were, I admittedly, I did not play Psychonauts 1. So
We got time if you want to take a break.
All right, let's knock that out real quick. So I had not been introduced to them until Raz comes across them. Well, they find him at the Motherlode. Oh, they were not in the first game. Okay.
Just the dad.
Okay. So when you were constructing his family and trying to look at the certain roles that the family members would have and their convictions and all of that, can you talk a little bit about how you came to decide why Donatella interacts with him the way that she does, and why the siblings are the way that they are? Like, how what was that process in crafting that?
Well, it was a little bit of trying to imagine, you know, like, you always try to create backstories and personalities for all your characters. So not just like this, like, group of people. And it occurred to me, like, Raz probably isn't the only psychic in his family, you know, and his family, they were a mix. The idea that they were a mix of, the circus has this rivalry between the fortune tellers and the acrobats, and they both think the other side is messed up. So that his dad, he thought that his dad was acrobat. He came from an acrobatic family, and they hated psychics. In the first game, that was a lot of the bad feelings Raz has, and why he ran away from home, is that he thought, like, he was a freak. He was a psychic, and his parents would hate him if they knew this, and he had to run away because he couldn't deny himself who he was anymore. He had to go find out what kind of psychic he was. And then his dad shows up and is like, our family is cursed to die in water, and so I'm trying to keep you safe, and I, you know, we don't, it's just that, you know, we don't hate psychics, we just, you know, fortune tellers cursed us, and, you know, he doesn't hate his son, like, that's one of the things that comes out in the, because he goes into his father comes into his mind and sees how Raz sees him, because there's another version of the dad, which is Raz's version, his interior version of the dad's like, I didn't realize I was this monster to you. You know, he gets to see how Raz sees him. So they come to this realization. And so, what was I talking about? Why was I going off about
Second the family?
You haven't played it, so I was going to relate the whole plot to it. Yeah. filling in the other, well, if that's one side of the family, that's where the psychic impulse comes from. Then maybe the mom's not psychic. And how does she feel about, you know, not being a psychic? She doesn't have the same empathy that the dad has in the end. And then various family members, you know, that maybe he has Frazee, his sister, who's also a secret. He knows that she's psychic, but they don't talk about it because they know it's forbidden in their family. And, like, what kind of tension does a secret like that create in the family? And an older brother, like, just comes, in some ways, just comes from me having an older brother who was pretty mean sometimes. And, like I know how the, you know, the older brother, younger brother dynamics were just very familiar to me. So sometimes you take just your own family experience, you know, and sometimes you take what the characters need, and you're always combining those two things. Like, what does the story need, and what can I pull from my own experience? Or someone, I can talk to someone and get someone else's experience to use as a structure here.
When I'm playing games and I'm analyzing them, or if I'm working with folks in a professional setting and I'm trying to understand family dynamics, one of the things that I'm consistently looking for is what makes sense and what doesn't relative to what I know about this family and their dynamics and their values and what's important to them. And usually that's something that becomes apparent just through observation, like, right? People bring things to me. And so then it's easy for me to look for those patterns and to see them. But I imagine it's a whole other deal to create that. I know I've said this a few times, but, like, there were so many times in playing the game where I was like, this is amazing in the way that this connects and this makes sense. And What is that? How does that process happen for you where you're thinking, okay, we need this to make sense, but we also don't want this to be a deep dive in a way that's going to get us off the rails? How do you check whether that actually works or not? Is it a felt experience? Is it just sort of like an understanding of certain principles that you're trying to put in the game? Like, how do you come to that point where you're able to craft something that makes so much sense that's easy to analyze?
Well, I don't want to ruin it, but sometimes it's like you're trying not to be too on the nose about stuff. Like, I think if we were too really like descriptive about the exact psychological theories behind every character, it'd be a lot easier to be like, you kind of like it's art, right? So art is about, we bring up topics, we suggest, you know, we put things, we make connections, we have interesting things happen. And then you as a player, you're kind of discounting all the work you did to make that make sense. Like you brought all your knowledge in there and like you kind of filled in the gaps and like, you know, spackled over the holes and like brought your own expertise to kind of tell a narrative where that totally made sense. So it's like a collaboration between the player and the designer, I think, a little bit. But, you know, we did the best job that we could. And, kind of like trying not to be vague, but you're trying to be open-ended to interpretation. Like if we were like, and this is really, we're just doing this because you should vote this way on this bill that's coming up. Like, I think no one finds that entertaining. Like you, you know, like a lot of people will say about games, like, we don't want to, we always tell a story, but some people are like, we don't want to tell our story. We want the player to tell their story. We want to give them tools so they can make their own story. Right. That's a lot like RPGs are a lot like that. Right. And mm-hmm. I think it's the same with, moral lessons or anything like that. Like I don't want to write a prescriptive moral lesson in any story that we're doing, but I want to just hand all these tools to the player so they can try out moral situations and see how they feel to them and tell their own like moral, you know, you play the game, you picked up all the tools that we laid in front of you and then you had this experience and then you came to your own conclusion. And that's all we really want for people, not to lay a moral on them, but to have them make their own decision. You know, I think like art, like a novel or anything like that, they help you figure out what you think about things by just letting you try on different skins and letting you try on different imaginary emotional situations in a safe way. Like, you know, if you read a love story, it's like this person's in love and they're heartbroken. Like, oh, you go through all these emotions, you feel all these things, but you're actually okay. Because you just read a book, you know, you're not actually heartbroken at the end of it, you know, even if it's super sad. But you got to feel all these things, which made you think about how you feel, and like you build those like emotional muscles, if that's a real thing. But you kind of mm-hmm. like you build the ability to deal with it a little better, you know. And I really believe in like that visualizing something in advance helps you deal with it later. So like, you know, these concepts of healing or therapy or something we put forward in the game, maybe a young player plays it and they don't like. Really just say like, I feel this way about therapy when they finish, you know, but they have these, they're familiar with these concepts and they have some idea of what a panic attack is. And maybe they have one and maybe they'll think about different tools they saw. And that's all it's about. It's like providing visual, like positive visualization of how someone might deal with the situation like this. So that when it happens to them, they can be like, well, I've seen this solved before. And I might mean, I don't do exactly what Raz does, but at least I know that, you know, there's a way to maybe this, it's fightable. It's deal. You can deal with it, you know?
But in that way, I will say there are many examples of that in the game where I can absolutely imagine myself even bringing it into, because I've played video games with clients before, and bringing that in and saying like, here's, you've been experiencing a lot of regrets. Here's a visual representation of that. And here's how this person, Raz, deals with that. And can we figure out a way that that connects to your own life? And that relatability, you know, how do we burn up the I think it's the doubts or the like fuzzy lint guys. Like, how do we burn these up? Like, how do we, what does this mean for you? I really think that you've accomplished something pretty special in that. And one of the most impactful moments of the game for me, and I think it connects a little bit with what we're talking about, from like an educational standpoint, was with the librarian. And to me, that was such a, like, Cassie's story is such a beautiful example of a theory. I don't know if you're familiar with it, called internal family systems.
And no, not that term. I heard it on your podcast, but
So yeah, it's this, it's basically this idea that like we have this whole internal world that's, we have ourself that's this like core good thing, and there are these parts that surround ourself that take on these different roles, and there's three different roles they take on: managers, firefighters, and exiles. And it's got some psychodynamic roots to it, where we talk about like these internalized objects, like you're talking about with like Raz and his father. But when I was going through the library and interacting with Cassie's parts, so to speak, it was this beautiful example of basically the idea is that if a part starts to drive your decision-making and your behaviors, you're going to have problems, because parts are very limited in their understanding of the world and they're very simplistic in their directives, but they're always acting empathically and protective to the person. And as I played through that, I even said this during the playthrough, I was like, if I was still teaching, because I taught as an assistant professor for a couple of years, I would absolutely show this entire segment as an example of what internal family systems can look like. And it's fascinating to me that like, it's not even something necessarily that was in your mind as you were crafting that moment, that like IFS was not the directed part of that, yet it's such a beautiful example of that theory and the way in which people's parts, when they take over, they cause all sorts of problems, like her librarian part does. And I just, that to me was such an impactful thing. And so to hear that that's something where like that openness to interpretation and what that means for the player, that was a moment for me where I was like, this is incredibly teachable. And then there's always a question, is like, did they mean to do this? And so it's amazing to hear that, not necessarily, but yet it's still a fabulous rep.
We didn't. Like, I think that's that stuff in Cassie's level is based on a different thing in psychology that we'd studied, which was Carl Jung and his mm-hmm. archetypes, which is very similar to what you're saying. I think you have that has a different terminology and maybe some different structures to it, and Carl Jung got into a whole bunch of stuff that some of it's a little more spiritual and doesn't apply. But the thing that he, you know, when we talked about archetypes living in your unconscious, has always stuck true to me. I mean, it really feels true in my brain that like there's this, people don't often talk about how that we're not just one person, that we have. This is the best example of this really dumb story. But back when TV channels were just cable, like 150 cable channels, I would sit there. When I was a single bachelor, like watching TV all night, just this is me flipping through channels. And I was sitting there flipping through channels until like midnight. And I was like, I should just go to bed. But now I'm flipping through all these channels and watching stupid TV shows. And I mean, I knew I should go to bed, but I wouldn't do it. And I finally learned this technique of reaching up with my left hand and turning off the TV with a remote. Like I would sneak up. My right hand was flipping through channels and I was watching TV, but my left hand would sneak up and turn off the TV. And it would break this charm, like, oh yeah, I should go to bed. And it was, and then I was like, wait, who's controlling the right hand and who's controlling the left hand? And like, who am I? Like, why do I have two minds? Like, why do I have two things I want to do? And I have to sneak up on myself to like do the right thing. And it just made me think about these, if they're these different, different driving force, different whole like personalities in your body, that, and they have different amounts of control over you. And sometimes one of them is driving all by themselves and then just hands up control. And for Carl Jung, it was kind of like, you know, when you come of age, that's why they have all these coming of age rituals in various societies, is because it helps bring the adult archetype out of your unconscious. Like, okay, rise up. You're in charge now. You're driving the ship, not the kid anymore. Kid can go away. Save the kid for when, you know, he goes to Disneyland, and like the adult can rise. And now you're an old, you need to be an old wise man. There are always like these passages in your life where a different like archetype is kind of giving the keys to the car. And it has felt very true to me, because I, you know, when we had our kid, I could just feel like, I feel like a different me is taking over to raise this kid. And it's not the, you know, the selfish single guy. It's some other version of me is now in control. And I just think that's really fun to, and you know, Cassie just says that to Raz. She's like, who are you? Are you the person you're with when you're with your girlfriend? Are you the person when you're with your family? Which one is the real Raz? Or are you some combination of all these different things? And And that's an example of leaving it that vague, I think, lets everyone interpret it and find truth in it. If I had said, like, this is based on the 1960s theory by Carl Jung, like, it would be like, well, I don't know if I believe that.
Well, Tim, but the archetypes go. Yeah, I could. Yeah, you open yourself up to a lot of criticism. You know, I saw an interview with you where you mentioned that the first Psychonauts had more of a Freudian spin on it, and then the second one made more of a transition over to more of a Jungian undertones. Is that part of just a product of your own, your like your own journey in connecting to more of the Jungian ideas, or was that an, was that something that was intentionally done? What kind of moved you through that transition to having more of an, a Jungian underpinning on Psychonauts 2 versus a Freudian one?
Yeah, that's a good question. Like, it's not like I thought they're both interesting. The Freudian one, I think, is more easy for people to grasp. Anyone who's watched a movie in the last, you know, 100 years, like the, every Hitchcock movie has this, like, oh, this person's a villain, and then, oh, it's because they saw this horrible thing when they were a kid or something. There's always this one trauma, and then that trauma is fixed, and the person snaps out of it, and they're like, fine. You know, so they're, so a lot of the levels in Psychonauts are based on, like, a past trauma that then gets fixed more, not instantly, but, like a key to a lock. Like, everyone's just like, you've got one lock, and they got one key, and you're better. And I think that was what people wanted psychotherapy to be in the 50s. You know, like that, we're going to this new world, and we could just, like, pop in, see the problem, fix it like your car, now you're good as good. You know, and then maybe that happens for some people, but it's usually messier than that. And I feel like the Jungian stuff I was bringing on was just a little more, has a little more subtlety and a little more just, it's not like an answer. It's not a prescriptive answer to a lot of things as much as more just like a way of finding more, a different way of looking at the human mind that is interesting for other reasons. And I think maybe more adaptive to a lot of different situations. Like, there's no one way of looking at the human mind that I think gives you all the answers for, you know, we're always finding new things all the time, but I think it's interesting to, so it's like the, so I feel like it's still the thing we know least about in the whole world. Like space.
Oh, totally.
And the mind.
Yep. Yes, absolutely. Is there a psychological figure that you have either like read about or come across in all of your time of looking at these things that you would most wish could play Psychonauts and give you their thoughts on it?
Oh, man, I'd be kind of scared because Freud and Jung would fight about it. And it's probably
they would indeed.
Gosh, I don't know. You know, some of the stuff was inspired by some like archaeological frauds that were, you know, there's a whole book written about dream theory in this one tribe where they would talk to, it was like a South American tribe where when the kids brought forth their dreams about, fighting a tiger, they dreamt about a tiger, and the dad would be like, well, you have to fight that tiger because that's gonna train next time you go to sleep, try and fight the tiger. And it was a kind of a bestseller, and people love this dream, like act of like lucid dream theory, like fighting things in your dreams to make you a braver warrior or whatever. And then it was one of those things where it was someone who just kind of fabricated the whole study, or it was exaggerated, like maybe, you know, but still was interesting to think about fighting your dream tigers.
Dreams are fascinating because we don't have that full understanding of exactly what they are and what they mean. And I'm calling back a little bit to something you said a little while ago, which is that really the dreams themselves are not as important as the person's interpretation of the dream and what that means. And there is a strategy sometimes that folks will use if they particularly have lucid nightmares, where you can create a bit of an expectation before you go to sleep of if there's a certain recurring figure that's in your nightmares or a certain recurring theme, that you can in some ways prepare yourself for that, to recognize certain patterns in that if you're lucid enough to recognize it as a dream and effectively pull yourself out of that dream or interact with it in a certain way. And so it's interesting how, like, but nobody really knows exactly how that works. Like, for some people that works and some people it doesn't. And that great, like, unexplored, understood aspect of the brain is something that it seems to compel so many people to create things and to explore certain things. And is it fair to say that, like, dream psychology is a strong influence on the approach you take to some of the psychology of, like, Psychonauts and stuff like that? You've mentioned dreams a couple times. Is that what appeals to you so much about that aspect that it's something that you find yourself continually revisiting?
It was in college, there was a class called Psychology of Dreams where a lot of these, I was exposed to the Freud book, the Jung book, the Tiger Dreams book, the Gestalt therapy. And I just thought it was so interesting because we all have dreams and it's such a mysterious, like, fantasy world that we all go into. And, you know, in that class, you start keeping a dream diary. And the thing you find out when you keep a dream diary is that you dream every night. you know, most of them are like, oh, I used to dream a lot, but I don't dream so much anymore. But it's mostly because you forget the sensors come out and stamp them all out. You wake up and they are erased from your brain. But if you keep a little notebook by your bed and try and write down as soon as you wake up what you dreamt about, you're like, oh my gosh, you get better and better at remembering them. And you're like, I dream every night. And then there are all these projects like try to draw what you saw in your dream. And sometimes you hear songs in your dreams and try to like write those down somewhere, record those somehow. And and just get more and more contact with it. It's just it's just this interesting fantasy world that we carry around with us that is just, you can't help but want to explore, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. What is the thing that when you look back on the creation of Psychonauts 1 and 2, the critical reception that the games have gotten, the personal feedback that you've gotten from people, your own experience playing the game and working on it, what would you say is the thing that you're most proud of, or that you would say was like the most successful aspect of the game for yourself?
I'm really happy with the response we got to the second game, that people felt, you know, despite a lot of the risks that we took, that we had, that it was a positive thing for so many people, especially people who have struggled with their mental health or just depression. You know, something in their life they've struggled with, and that the game helped them imagine fighting it. You know, helped them imagine, you know, that the game gave them some tools to, like, help them deal with their own struggles. I think that means a lot, because it, you know, it starts off, you know, 20 years ago with trying to make something like entertaining and funny, you know, and just, and that we, by going into the human mind, you know, in an empathetic way, you can't help but like deal with, you know, all the vast things that go on in people's minds. You know, there's so many things that are like, you know, heavy, or, you know, can be traumatic, and they can, you know, can be beautiful, and they go on in the human mind. And I think, it just led us, as we went down that creative journey, getting more and more in touch with like what we wanted to make artistically, but also like what kind of connections we wanted to have with people, and what responsibilities we had to people. And by the end of it, I felt like we were all really, the whole team was really proud of what we made, and what, you know, Raz as a character, and how he put this really positive and empathetic vision out there into the world about these topics.
And conversely to that, is there any aspect of the game that you look at now in hindsight and you wish had been fleshed out more, or had received maybe more attention or depth, that if you had like a magical development time to be able to push it into the game, that you would push in there?
I mean, yeah, there's always more character development for all the side characters. You wish I could go and get into more of the lives of the interns and see more Sasha and Mia time, because you have to make choices about what to focus on with the game. We were focused on, you know, an older generation in this one, you know, and that was something we liked, and we liked all those characters, but I wish I could have more time for all the characters, of course.
So I admire, it's cool I get to tell you this to you directly, I admire that you and the team were willing to take on psychology in video game format, and that you were willing to do it so thoughtfully and empathically, and really cared, it sounds like, about the representation and what effect that would have on people. And so it's not just a story about Raz, it's really in some ways a story about all of us and the way that we connect with our own minds and the people around us. And I really think that you guys nailed that. Like, I really do believe that. And so if there were other game developers that said, you know, this whole idea of jumping into psychology and really trying to integrate psychology into our game, maybe as a major theme or as a secondary theme, is really important to us, what would you, given your experience doing this now for as long as you have, what kind of advice or word to the wise would you give about really intentionally putting psychology as a aspect of your game?
The big lesson for us was, don't just pull from the kind of set stereotypes you have in your mind. Like, I've seen movies, I know how people act when they're depressed or whatever. You know, you have to, it's a combination of like research, like reading books about these topics, but also your life and your life of your family and your life of your friends and their family, like just personal, experiences of people on the team. It's like, well, you know, I had an uncle who was alcoholic and he acted nothing like that. You know, just like, and that way, it's not just about psychology, but just good writing in general is based on basing it on reference, basing it on the world we actually experience. And then when people see that, it just feels more real to them. And it's a better work of art, and it's a better representation of, you know, you say psychology, but it's just in some ways just people, just like, this person feels real. This character feels real to me. You know, it's something we all want, whether we'd say we're making a psychological game or not. It's like, we've seen cackling evil people in games, and just like, people just take that. Well, I got this template for how villains work. They got to have this kinky thing about them. They got to wear a weird piece of clothing, and they got to have a bald cat. You know, and you're just like, they have these like things that trigger you. Like, oh yeah, it's evil. That person's messed up. But if you really look at the best villains and the best heroes, you know, they're all based on these, they have these really specific character traits that feel like a real person would have them. So I feel like just doing the real research, whether it's personal or academic, and then making the characters really specific and true instead of based on stereotypes or preconceived notions, I think is better for all writing, whether it's psychological or not.
Sure. Are there any characters in Psychonauts that you personally feel like you would struggle with interacting with or talking to or handling?
Oh, gosh. You mean besides the Milagilla who would drown me?
Right.
I mean, I try to pride myself on getting along with most people, so I think I would just be able to adapt, you know, my... There's that Vernon in the first game tells really, really long stories. That's often a nightmare for me, is being trapped in a conversation I can't get out of. But I try to... There's a way to usually talk to or, you know, get along with most people, I think. Maybe that's the lesson of the game. Maybe that's the lesson.
Is there... a lot of these are just these minor curiosities I had throughout the game and thinking about like your experience of creating it. Is the reception of any particular character? Has there been any that surprised you where people were like, oh, I really love this person, or I can't stand this person, or somebody you've seen somebody react to where you're like, oh, that's not what I was expecting at all of how a person would react to this person.
And that's happened to me in general outside of games. I mean, I was writing this, I was trying to write the screenplay once when I was younger, and I read it in this writing group, and everyone was like, oh, you know, it was supposed to be about this girl breaking up with this really jerky guy. And I read the whole thing, and then everyone was like, when is that guy ever going to find true love? And it's like, wait, he's not the good guy. But I had given him all the funny lines because he was a jerk. So he had all the funny lines, so everyone liked him more. And I'm like, oh, God, that definitely happens. And that's why you have to, like, test your stuff. You think you've... You can never just imagine. You write something, you never know how it's going to read with people, for sure. But you know, we have so much time with these characters because the team plays them and reads all the dialogue and stuff. So hopefully, if we're really off the mark, it'd be caught by someone in playtest or in the team, or in, you know, they would catch it before it got out. Surprise. I mean, people have suggested romantic relationships that I had not anticipated. I'll tell you that. There's a lot of art depicting romantic relationships between characters that's new to me, but I'm glad you found that. I'm glad you found that in that, you know, who knows? Who am I to say who would get together in that game?
Sure. Sure. Is that, what's, when you see that kind of like, you know, fan art and these spinoffs and stuff like that, is that weird as a developer to see that kind of stuff? Or I mean, is the there best. Some say, like, pride in that? Okay.
You're trying to make something that feels real to people. And if those characters felt so real that they wanted to like develop them further and see them do more things, then that's awesome. You've nailed it.
So as a person who has never created a video game and has not, you know, been able to see people, not just see the characters that I've created, but also like actually interact with them and connect with them. What is it like for you to see, like to see that, like to see Psychonauts 2 and to have that, have the game be completed and to have people like interacting with these characters that you've put so much time into creating? Like just what is that like as a developer to experience that?
I mean, it's the best, but you rarely, as a video game developer, you almost rarely get that because you read reviews or you might see someone. Now you can Twitch, you can watch someone like your stream. I can watch someone entertain. And that's a new thing for games. You know, like before we just kind of send them off and get a review in a magazine and be like, oh, I hope people liked it. And then years later, someone's like, oh, I played that game with my dad when I was a kid and that was my favorite. It's like, oh, 10 years later, I'm so glad that someone liked that. And it's like, we've had some experiences. We did, a live read of dialogue from Grim Fandango with live music in front of a live audience. And I was like, oh my God, this is so much different. These people are right here telling us they're clapping. Like, it's so much different than making video games. But I have been able to like lurk and spy on people playing the games. And just certain things that you hope play a certain way. When you see like a smile across someone's face down that little box in the corner, you're like, yes, yes. Cause it's so great when a plan comes together. And again, it's such a team effort because I'll have an idea for something, but like every layer of it, whether it's the character design, the actor does so much in the studio to like, you know, bring this character to life. And then the animator like just does a little thing with the eye and like, ooh. And you know, sometimes it's just the music or the effects or something that will just like layer upon layer of meaning in every scene that take in, every experience you have in the game, that it's and then seeing that all add up to just an emotional reaction to someone, and it's just like a laugh, or someone does a big belly laugh or something like that. That's one of the great things why we do it.
Sure. You get to see a real tangible, cool impact that you have on people that extends beyond, I think, what a lot of people get to experience. And I love hearing people talk about what that's like to see, because I think it's such an anomalous human experience to really see a wide ripple effect of something that you've created. And obviously you've been doing it for so many years and have had so many games that have touched so many people that I always like to take the opportunity to ask that question, because it's such a unique thing that I think a lot of people wish they could accomplish or do.
You have to remind yourself about it a lot too, because that's why I like going to, back when we could before COVID, like go to a trade show where the actual players come up and talk to you, because you don't get that feedback a lot. And just games have such an impact on people, like books and movies, but a totally different way, that you'll meet someone and you can just tell they're very emotional talking to you because they had all these emotions when they played the game. It's like, wow, that's a lot of responsibility. Like that's one of the reasons you like take this really seriously, you know, because this stuff really matters to people. And you have to remind yourself of that just for your own inspiration and mental health, because you always mostly just remember like the mean Twitter comments. Like, you know, anything creatively you do and like you get 100 nice comments, you'll remember the one yep, mean yep. one, because I don't know why that is. It's just such a, you know, you have to kind of force yourself to like think about, remember that person who came up and they shook your hand, like you really touched that person, but yeah but that other guy, you know. So you know, creative stuff is really, it leads you raw, like wide open. And the internet is like the worst place to be raw and wide open, you know? And so I think just kind of build up this like callous, like you just got to train yourself to like, I think about that stuff a lot. Like if you're living by creativity, it's like you don't know exactly where it comes from sometimes. So you have to kind of like take care of that. You have to take care of your brain and like train it to like, you're living off the ideas it has. So you have to like treat it like take care of like a pet or something. You gotta make sure it's fed well and like, and take it out for exercise, and you gotta feed it new things once in a while, and you can't just lock it in a cave all day. And like, there are all these metaphors for like taking care of a pet and taking care of your brain, because like you're that's your moneymaker, which is a really kind of crass way to put it, but you just if you want to have continued creative ideas like all of your life, you have to feed and tend that organ in your body, you know. And part of that is like how to deal with feedback and how to make sure it's not overly negative, you know honest but not overly negative effect on your creative output, you know.
Sure. I want to be respectful of your time, so I have one more question for you. And I just want to say how much I appreciate that you have taken the time to talk with me. It really is an honor.
Big honor to be here. Thank you.
It's super cool. So I don't know if Psychonauts 3 is a thing that's on your guys' radar or not. I'm not going to ask you to tell me whether it is.
We're not working on that right now.
Okay, fair enough. I would imagine, I've heard you say in the past a few times that like you like the idea of, I think there was an interview I saw recently where you said that you like the next project to be like on the other side of the continuum of the most recent project. But I have to imagine that there are things that you learned through your process of creating Psychonauts and injecting some of these like human principles into it that in such a deliberate way would have to have a profound impact on how you see projects going forward. Is there a certain takeaway or takeaways from the process of creating Psychonauts that you intend to carry over into future projects and want to make sure that you continue to implement because of how well it went? with Psychonauts.
Yeah, I mean, it's always, you know, we're always applying the learning that we got from this game. We had a, you know, this is actually a rough development. We had a lot of early on some rancor in the team, you know, this stuff. We're making a documentary about it. It's going to be visible to everybody. But, you know, coming out of that, it really put us in touch with our values as a company and like really doubly like recommitting to the things that we felt make collaboration and creative working together more possible. You know, like mutual respect, you know, openness and communication, you know, positive, like learning how to talk to each other when it comes to honest feedback and stuff like that, that I think were really helpful lessons on that team. And so it's almost more of the team dynamic things that I think we want to bring forward and apply. And of course, mountains of technical knowledge and the sure. team learning how to use Unreal and all that stuff. We've learned a lot. And building a whole new engine on top of that. So definite lessons going forward. But we also just like to try new things. I mean, I think the idea of taking care of your brain like a pet is part of it is like trying new things all the time. And what don't you know? And like, let's try and do something we don't know how to do just so we can continually be growing and not feel, you know, otherwise I think you'll just run out of gas.
Sure.
If you don't follow your inspiration, wherever it leads.
You and Double Fine... I know that you're part of Double Fine. I don't know that you like the separation of yourself from Double Fine, but Double Fine, it has become pretty clear to me just through interactions that I've had with you and the team and playing Psychonauts that, and I've also played Broken Age. I really loved Broken Age, by the way. You guys are doing it right. It sounds like, and I love that you guys are getting, you know, got the support from Microsoft that you've gotten and that the critical acclaim is coming your way because, you know, as somebody who is, you know, literally I've dedicated my life to a profession that directly lines up with what you've created in Psychonauts. It's really cool to see just the amount of care and time that you guys have taken to really represent something that touches everybody. Mental health and psychology is something everybody experiences. And I think it's really cool that you guys are willing to take that stuff on, that you're so thoughtful about it, and that you've created something that allows people like me to educate other people and take it to a level of depth that it deserves. So I thank you. And I thank the team for all the support of my playthrough and for creating what you've created. And I am seriously, I'm so honored that you took the time to talk to me. It is one of the great honors so far of my journey as a content creator to be able to talk with you. And I am really grateful that you took as much time as you did out of your schedule to speak with me and to watch my playthrough.
Because
it's super cool of you to do.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's my honor to be here. And I can say you're right. The team, to every single one, every single member of that team, they care tremendously about every aspect of that game. And there was so much love and care put into that game. That's why it was so fun to watch your stream and see someone really appreciate and really dig deep into all of that. So thanks for playing.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Absolutely my pleasure. Thank you so much, Tim.
Thanks. Good talking to you.